The Senate Higher Education Budget Division will come to order, and I'm hoping that we'll have a little quicker meeting than we might have originally planned. I'm sorry we're starting late, so that people can get home before the blizzard rush hour. And it sounds like most Senate's 3 o'clock committees are being canceled. We've become wimps in terms of winter now. Can't handle it. Senator Skoy, Senate File 786, why don't you come and tell us about your bill?
Madam Chair and members, pleased to be before the Higher Ed Committee with Senate File number.
We miss you.
Yes, and I miss the committee, Madam Chair. I have had regrets about my committee assignments, but as we move on, Senate File 786 is a bill dealing with the state grant and a number of other higher ed components to that. Section 1 is probably the most important and the largest component of this bill, and that is reducing the student share from 46% to 40%. And, Madam Chair, members, when I think about what's going on with regard to our college population and the amount of debt that they are carrying as they graduate, this original part that is the assigned student responsibility is primarily what they end up borrowing. And they have to borrow that component, and then the rest becomes help to them based on need. And so if we are able to move forward and reduce this component, it would move toward reducing the amount of debt that students are having to carry as they graduate from higher ed institutions. Section 2 has a couple of components. The first component is a change to the cap with regard to the state grant program. Currently, it's set at the highest of the University of Minnesota tuitions. I do believe that the University of Minnesota is going to go over that this year and would have a number of programs that would also be over the cap. So what the effort is here is to change the cap from a number established in law to the average of the University of Minnesota tuition and fees. And hopefully that would allow the University of Minnesota to remain within the current state grant mechanism, so we don't have students there that would not be qualified. The second portion of this section deals with the proration for part-time students with regard to the state grant, where we currently prorate the living and miscellaneous expenses. This bill would not prorate that, and so that would recognize that the living expenses occur whether they're full or part-time students, and would be an increase for those students that are part-time students. Section 4 is a provision dealing with child care, increasing the maximum award for parents, single parents primarily, for child care grants from the current $2,300 to $3,600. I think this is a recognition of the importance that we have all of these young people and single parents being able to attend college if they have desires to, and to assist them in the child care as they forward their higher education. Section 4 deals with the two-year program cap. We really didn't want to make that determination, so I think we'll like to include the two-year institutions and the committee into the discussion as to what that cap should be increased to, but we know that if we are adjusting the four-year cap, we're also going to have to take a look at that. And Section 5 is the appropriation for the child care grants. Madam Chair and members, I'm here with David Laird. He's head of the Minnesota Private Colleges Council, and he would like to provide some additional information and support, and hopefully help me answer questions the committee may have. And so with that, I'd turn it over to Mr. Laird.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Laird.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Laird, the President of the Minnesota Private College Council. I'm aware of your admonition about time, so I will try to be very brief and be happy to answer questions and be part of a conversation if you wish. I'd like to mention two parts of the context for this and other recommendations that our board has made to you this year. From where we sit, and remember that our board has more business leaders on it than college presidents, from where we sit, there are two major winds of change which are blowing very hard on Minnesota and those of us in the upper Midwest. The first that you're very much aware of are the changes in demographics. And we need to remember that the demographic changes that are occurring are not just the new face that you can see in the rotunda if you came by a moment ago, but Minnesota is in the process of becoming older, more retired, and less well-educated. And that plays into the other major wind of change, and the little cards in front of you are intended to remind all of us that we're no longer the center of the universe if we ever were, that things are changing around the world, and there is global competition, particularly for human capital. And most of the leaders all around the world are saying to all of us and each other that those who produce the intellectual capital for the future are the states or nations that are going to be the leadership for the future. Based upon those two changes, our view is that the changes that are recommended in financial aid here are urgent. The longer we wait, the more difficult it's going to be to fill in the gaps for the retirees, and the fewer students we're going to have to fill in the economic demands that our business community are already identifying. In order to meet the combination of retirements of the baby boom generation, which, by the way, is the best educated cohort in our society, we have no replacement right now for that cohort. In order to replace them and continue to add for the new jobs that our business community intends to create, we need to double the number of bachelor degree recipients that we produce every year. And that isn't going to come by wishful thinking. And the financial aid is intended to provide the opportunity for access and success for a new part of the population that we believe ought to be part of our future. One other comment. Many of us have been looking at student groups within the current student population as it pertains to their financial aid and the way in which they are actually financing of higher education. Senator Scoy made mention of the amount of borrowing. In 2005, our students and families broke the $1 billion mark in borrowing in this state, which is not something we ought to be aspiring to, and not something we ought to hope to perpetuate. There are two groups in the current student body that are really suffering under the current methodology and the current terms of our state financial aid system. The first are the lowest income students, and for them the reality is that every time tuitions go up in either public or private, that goes right to the bottom line of what they have to borrow. And as Senator Scoy said, if we can adjust elements within the state grant program, we can reduce the portion of their expenses that they have to borrow. The second group that we all know, many of them are our neighbors, are the middle-income families whose circumstances cause them to be just above the cusp of eligibility for both state and federal financial aid. And the combination of the factors that we're recommending change here are intended to provide some relief to both of those groups. And we look forward to working with you and your committee, Madam Chair, and we look forward to working with people from the other systems that are serving these students now and hope to serve them in the future. And we urge you to give serious consideration to these changes as an urgent priority.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from members of the committee? I'm trying to understand, what does it mean? I guess the living and miscellaneous allowance being prorated maybe predates me, because we've been running surpluses and we've been using the LME to adjustment to deal with our surpluses. So what does it mean when you say it shall not be prorated? What kind of impact would that have? And you can tell me, and I can also ask. Maybe Mr. Misconis would know if he's here. Okay.
Madam Chair, that pertains to the way in which part-time student grants are being treated.
Okay.
Not everyone.
And Madam Chair, Madam Chair, currently the way I understand this is if you're a part-time student, your grant award is prorated based on your tuition and fees, and also your living expenses are reduced and cut in half because you're theoretically only there half-time. But this is kind of a recognition that those part-time students have living expenses probably more than just half because they're there, and so we're actually going to try to increase that component for the part-time student, which would increase their grant award.
So you've looked at, we've talked about that before, that we have a system where part-time students can't access the state grant and is, you know, as easily as other full-time students. And since we have more and more students going part-time, we really need to look at that. Well, I appreciate you doing that, since a lot of your students, most of your students are going full-time, I'm sure.
Well, Madam Chair, that component and the child aid grant component really are targeted at, in my thought, would be the more non-traditional student.
Right. So the other way we could go with the child care grant is we could put more money into it. So the question there then, members, is the money gets spread around to more people. What's the waiting list? You know, what's the demand? Or is this, it's an unrealistic amount. $3,600 is closer to what the real cost is for a student in terms of paying for child care. I heard another number. Does someone else have a bill raising the child care allowance, but it's more like to $2,600 or $2,800? Did it sound familiar to anybody? Okay, maybe I dreamt it.
Well, Madam Chair,
Mr. Laird,
particularly for new members, this was one of the accounts that was reduced in the budget squeeze 4 years ago, and this would fully restore those cuts at the time. And it's our belief, our estimates right now, that this funding would be sufficient to reduce the waiting list.
But if you're raising the per person, the per amount per child, I don't quite understand how that reduces the waiting list. The overall appropriation would. Do you have a recommendation for an overall appropriation?
Yes.
Okay. It's just not in the bill.
And
6.4 million, is that the
Madam
number?
Chair, I think the numbers that I, and I apologize for not having a fiscal note yet, but we will be
getting
one.
No, we have one.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, we have fiscal note.
I think it's from approximately 4 million currently, and I think this would raise it to about 8. Is that in line with
the fiscal note says 6.4 a year for child care.
Deal.
The
6.4 increase.
I think, though, we still have to clarify, though, if that will serve more students or it's just giving more money per student, and we'll check that. Well, your desire is to do both.
Well, Madam Chair and members, we're really bringing this forward for the committee to become aware that we think it's important that we deal with the child care. We know that there were significant cuts in 2003, and we would like the committee to do their best work in this area.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you talk a little more about what the real on-the-ground impact is to this for all the different institutions if you shift to this language about averaging? The tuition and fee maximum for a student enrollment in a four-year program is the average, eliminating the establishment under the law. What it really, I need to understand what that really means when it plays out to the various institutions who are using the grant system.
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, currently the cap for what students are eligible for in the state grant is set at the highest level of the highest program of the University of Minnesota. It was established, I don't know how many years ago, but a number of years ago, and the tuition increases are occurring at the university. So they will have programs that are over the cap that students will not be able to receive state grant dollars to cover the cost of the program. This is an effort to try to have a policy in place that adjusts as the University of Minnesota tuition and fees goes up. The cap would rise along with that. And this mechanism has been worked through with the University of Minnesota, and perhaps, Mr. Laird, you could talk about the process that you went through to establish this mechanism.
How much does the cap cost? Mr. Laird.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, over the 35 years in which this program has been in operation, there have been several different ways of trying to calculate what the recognized tuition and fees ought to be for the purpose of calculating in the state grant program. And there's always been a concern that that in state policy and in appropriations, we not set up an incentive for institutions in the private sector to raise their tuitions just to capture more financial aid dollars. So from nearly the beginning, there has always been what we've called a governor in the formula that makes sure that that incentive doesn't exist for private colleges. And lately, for the last 8 or 10 years, the legislature has been using either the number that is derived from the university's highest cost or some other calculation for the purpose of setting that. It doesn't, in all frankness, it doesn't bear much of a relationship to the real cost of tuition and fees in the private sector. Last year, among our 17 institutions, that number was 24,000 and change. And the private colleges have never requested that the legislature recognize more than what we've been able to agree on in the calculation of that governor or the cap. So the purpose here is to recognize for students in 4-year programs an upper limit on how much of the tuition and fees can be recognized in the formula, and that would apply to students in both public systems and in the private sector who are in 4-year programs.
What is the average tuition at the U? How much would we be raising that cap to?
Madam Chair, I think the current cap is $94.38, mm-hmm. and I believe this would bring it to $98.33.
But then it floats as the University of Minnesota tuition goes up.
Correct.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, part of the rationale for this, and I think the university agrees with us, is that we don't need to come forward every year and go through the traditional arguments about this when it's set at that level or by that mechanism.
Madam Chair, then that would have to be part of the calculation that the Office of Higher Education would make in projecting if we have enough money or not, the tuition at the U.
Madam Chair, traditionally, that's one of the last factors that you use in determining your appropriations for the biennium. So, yes.
And
Madam Chair, did you want to add to that?
Senator
Skoy.
Yeah, just briefly, the $98.33 plus whatever University of Minnesota tuition and fee increases there are this year.
Ooh. And does the fiscal note make some assumptions about that?
Well, I was just looking at the fiscal note, and I think they did. And what I'm seeing here, I'll have to review
They're using 9923 and 10420.
Yes.
Okay, good. Senator Sharon.
So that means that one of the changes is that it is the University of Minnesota that will establish what the tuition amount is used for grant for the grant appropriations, rather than it
maximum
being developed within each system. Well, is that correct?
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the way I understand this is it has, I don't have a long history, so, but the last few years it has been the University of Minnesota that has been establishing that as the highest and most expensive program they had, plus their fees was the number. And then the legislature would take that number and establish it in law. But as I listened to Mr. Laird, that hasn't always been the case, you know, but that has been the case the last number of years.
Well, I think we actually had a higher cap than the university's tuition in the past, and now the university has been increasing so much, they keep bumping on the cap.
Okay,
but if you go to a Minsky institution, they take the tuition maximum there. It's just the cap only really applies at private institutions or the for-profits. Okay. Any other? I think I understand. Any other questions? Anybody else in the audience want to testify on the state grant? Senator Skoy?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just briefly in closing, you know, we had a joint tax and finance committee meeting today, and Dr. Stinson was talking to the committee about the state of Minnesota's economy and our future, and for the higher ed committee and really the Senate, he did say that our work, the workforce in Minnesota and how well we do educating that workforce is really the most important thing that we are going to do as policymakers in determining Minnesota's long-term future. And so as you struggle with this and as we all struggle with our budget issues and scarce resources, I would hope that we'd look at some of these. I think that the grant changes really do target our scarce resources to where they will do good work in this area. But I do wish you as a committee good luck with your efforts because it's very important for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. We did have someone who wanted to testify, Mr. Stanton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Russ Stanton, Interfaculty Organization, which State University faculty. Just very briefly, I mean, we've had these discussions over the cap for many, many years. I would just point out to the committee members that if you raise the cap, it'll help the private college students, it'll help the University of Minnesota students, but it won't help a single student in Minsky because none of them are near the cap. Not one penny will go to them. I would agree with Mr. Laird's comments about the demographic changes that are occurring in our society, a lot more underrepresented folks and so forth. I would also point out that they go to Minsky schools. That's where the largest number go, are to Minsky schools. And it isn't that we mind seeing people getting more money, but if there's limited resources available, we would encourage people to look at ways to spread those out more evenly across all the systems, for instance, by raising the LME, which would benefit everyone equally. So that's our position. We've maintained it for years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. I think that is, the LME is in this bill in terms of family responsibility being reduced. That's a huge, that's $43 million a year. And the other change, the part-time student, which mostly benefits public school kids, that's $40 million a year. So I think there's some, and those are the parts that we probably have more difficulty doing, because those are the big ticket items.
Madam Chair, I know that we don't want to drag on too much longer, but I just want to briefly say that when we look at higher education in Minnesota, Minsky can't educate all the kids. The University of Minnesota can't educate all the students that we have, and the private colleges can't. We have all of these institutions. They're all important. We need to be aware of what the Minnesota State Colleges and University issues are and what the University of Minnesota issues are and what the other institutions in Minnesota are, because we need them all. We need to get as many of our population going and improving themselves through higher education that we can. And so I would hope that we take a balanced approach to this and, you know, support Mr. Stanton in his effort to bring balance to this. Thank you.
Mr. Laird.
Time for a closing comment, Madam
Sure.
Chair. First, the weather, I think, has probably limited the number of folks who were able to come today and participate with us.
It stopped snowing. I don't know what people were so afraid of. You know, the whole world's going to shut down.
It was the gavel.
Not even snowing anymore.
It was the gavel that did it. At your place is a sheet that talks about statements of support, and we think it's important to recognize that there are several groups and organizations that have supported these recommendations. The Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, the State Council on Black Minnesotans, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the Minnesota TRIO Association, which cuts across all three systems, very favorable comments in both the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press, and several other groups that have come forward, including the Girl Scout Council of the St. Croix Valley. Parting comment on our part. This is from the board as well as our office. We should not allow ourselves to assume that these changes only affect the students that we're talking about. If we are unable to meet the challenges brought on by both competition and demographics, our future standard of living and the future viability of our economy in this state are in the balance.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Senator Skoy. Then
may I just ask one more question?
Oh,
I know.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. When I was running for election, I met with some of the leadership at Gustavus in St. Peter, and they talked about a group that of college presidents that involve both Minsky University and private colleges that come together and talk about this very issue of how to deal with the grants programs, and that they negotiate out a formula in which this is to be distributed. Has that group met and reviewed this and talked about this, or have I heard something that or made something up in my mind, dreamt it, as Senator Pappas says, that exists, that maybe should, but doesn't? Do you know? Can you answer that?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I suspect that's more hope than fact.
Oh.
I've been at this for a long time here in Minnesota, and in my recollection, the only body that's really negotiated these things over the years has been the legislature.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Justin McMartin. I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to bring up kind of the views of the Minnesota State University Student Association on these types of things. We recognize the need to increase money into these programs and the importance of them, but in light of tuition increases over the past couple of years at our institutions, we would just urge that because of the significant dollar amounts that would go into these, that we could address that tuition problem first before committing so much money into these programs. It's just that in many cases, when they were talking about the underrepresented students, many of those students have a lot of sticker shock when they see the cost of education. And, you know, our institutions are the cheapest in the state, and to allow us to continue to keep those low, I think would be to our advantage. So I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood where our students stood on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Someone want to make a motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I move that Senate File 786 be laid over for consideration in the omnibus higher ed bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. Okay, Ms. Hegard and Senator Roebling and Senator Erickson Ropes. You want to come up as a team and talk about the governor's GI Bill and what's happened in the Ag Committee?
Does
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm glad to be here today. This is the second hearing for Senate File 408, and I'm not sure about Senator Roebling's bill.
Madam Chair, we've been hearing 575 for several different days.
Right.
Okay. So we're going to, I guess, double team on this. I would just like to remind the committee, and actually I would like to have Senator Scoy and Mr. Laird come back and do some testimony for us, because the same points, I think, apply to the GI Bill and funding educational opportunities for our veterans, that one of the biggest things that this nation did was create the federal GI Bill in the early 1940s, and that helped to build the middle class of the nation. And it's when you invest in education, you are, in fact, investing in the vitality of the nation and the state and our economic future. So I'm pleased to bring you another bill that will give you an opportunity to do that.
Senator Erickson Robes, we just actually wanted to hear from the governor's people. We're going to do both. Yeah, we're going to hear what the governor's proposal is, and then we're going to talk about how your bill as it comes from the Veterans Committee. Okay.
Madam Chairman, ask Mr. Mishkanis to speak on this bill.
Right. Madam Chair and members, again, Mark Mishkanis from the Office of Higher Education. This would be Article
4.
Starts on page 27. But more generally speaking, the goal here, the governor's recommendation is to pick up the various pieces of educational services that aren't paid for veterans, that are the eligibility of which are laid out in the bill, that aren't covered by other public programs. And this would include both the Pell Grant and the state grant, as well as the variety of federal educational programs. And it is a variety and actually fairly complicated. We do have a number of tables that might help you understand that at some point.
You're going to give me more than I'm giving you.
But the idea is to give fairness and the parity to the veterans that have served since early 1990 through those that would be returning, of course. This bill has been worked on going back to last summer with a large group of people, including I think many of the stakeholders, the Veterans Affairs Group Department, a number of the folks from the education sectors. So there's been a lot of work involved in putting the bill together in the first place. This would be a program that's run out of our office, much like the other grant programs that we run now. I'm not sure how much detail do you want us to get into it. The two bills are fairly similar in many ways. There are a number of differences that affect.
Well,
the cost.
Would be good to know what the original, you know, governor's proposal was. I'm not exactly sure how that's different from the AG's proposal and how that's different from the bill we have before us from Senator Robes Erickson from the Ag Committee. So I'd like to kind of hear a little bit of a outline of maybe what the governor had been working on and then from the other perspectives.
Well, Madam Chair, I will try to summarize it, I guess, the best I can. The governor's bill would take the cost of attendance, both for undergraduate and graduate students, as defined in the state grant program. So you just heard the conversation about the state, the cap for the tuition maximums. That would, of course, apply within that as well. And then multiply that by a factor of 1.2. So you essentially increase that budget above the levels currently. And part of the reasoning for that was initially when we did the work on this, there were a number of veterans that wouldn't receive any benefits under the program without that multiplier.
So that's the eligibility part.
So that the idea was, okay, if you, there was some sense that all veterans should get some benefit out of this program. So one the device used was to increase or multiply that budget by an amount to assure they would get something out of it.
Okay.
Again, there is a number of definitions in the bill on page 28. I think those are similar to the other, to Senate File 408. The eligibility on page 29 lays out what a veteran needs to do in order to qualify, have served in the armed forces since August 2nd of 1990. And there's a number of provisions there. A surviving spouse or child would also be a beneficiary under the bill. I think that's similar in both bills.
So your eligibility is not based on any particular conflict or war or any particular assignment? Like, it's not just for, you know, people who are in a war zone or people who are in the Iraq war, or it's broader than that? It's anybody, including obviously National Guard, who served since 1990. Darn, my husband isn't eligible. Yes.
Madam Chair, my name is Tim Med. I'm with the Office of Higher Education. The basic eligibility requirement is you have had to have served after August 2nd, 1990, which is the day of the first Iraq War basically started. If you have served 181 consecutive days, you're eligible. If you've served in the National Guard Army Reserve for 16 years, I believe it is, you're then eligible. Meet one of those two definitions. Or if you serve 90 days in a war zone and are a member of the National Guard.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling.
The dependents are for Minnesota veterans, eligible Minnesota veterans and their children, and spouses of deceased and severely disabled veterans. So it isn't all children of veterans. It's only those whose parent had been killed in the war or were severely disabled as a result of their participation in the military.
Well, maybe we should be helpful to ask, Senator Senator Ropes Erickson. Can I just call you Senator Erickson or Senator Ropes?
Ropes.
Keep tripping over my tongue. Senator Ropes. Now, in terms of eligibility, does your bill differ from that, or is it the same or similar?
Well, actually, to back up just a little bit, I will say that when this process first began, Senator Lynch and I were both working on similar bills. Senator Lynch, I believe, got hers via Senator Vickerman, who's the chair of the Veterans Committee, and I got my initial bill from the AG's office. And we sat down with those two bills, put them side by side, and actually I believe it was the governor's original language, compared how they were the same and how they were different. And Senator Lynch and I decided to merge them together and worked with Margaret Vessel from the governor's office, Ben Wogsland from the attorney general's office. Christine Keel was in on those conversations. She's here today from the Department of Veterans Affairs, and Susan Heger from Higher Ed. And it was my understanding that all the stakeholders, if you will, of all these different organizations had come to a consensus bill that we brought to the Agriculture and Veterans Committee.
Okay.
And so I'm...
So they're not competing bills. We're looking at Senate File 408.
In Senate File 408, it's the integrated bills that all of those stakeholders agreed upon to roll into one bill that we brought to the Ag Committee.
But there were changes made in the Ag Committee that not everyone might agree with?
There was one amendment added, only having to do with the number of credits covered. That was the only amendment added in the Veterans Committee.
It was my understanding that the original bill had a $1,000 cap per semester and that the AG's proposal was a different kind of limit.
Right. The governor's bill, I think, originally went to a $10,000 lifetime expenditure and $1,000 per semester and or up to, I think there was a certain number of...
300 per fiscal year.
3,000 per fiscal year. And the amendment that was attached in the Veterans and Agriculture Committee extended that to 128 credits or 8 semesters and took off the lifetime cap.
And took off both the $1,000 and the $10,000 limit.
Right. Okay. So the eligibility requirements were not changed at all. It was just the benefit.
Okay. So what we're discussing is in kind of a world of limited resources, you know, how much money do we have to spend on this program, and then how should we what kind of limits do we need to have? For example, I've suggested that perhaps graduate school, we wouldn't include graduate school as a limit. You could go back to the, we don't have a final fiscal note on this, but the preliminary fiscal note is quite high, and I don't have that money in my budget. Mm-hmm. So we have to think about how we can bring this into kind of a more controllable range. In fact, I was late for this meeting because I was meeting with the finance chair, who just took up between 40 and 70 million out of my proposed target that I had a couple days ago. So I have even less money than I had a couple days ago. We could, the committee, this is up to us now. The Veterans Committee said they wanted it to be unlimited, but of course they weren't paying for it. They gave it to us to pay for it. And that was lovely to do, but we have to actually put together a real budget. It's no more laid over for consideration. We have to consider. Senator Erickson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, in fact, we had considerable discussion about that, whether we needed to attach a dollar amount. We did believe philosophically we want to make it available to as many veterans as possible, and would forward to you, you know, the intent of the committee, which was to give as much educational opportunity to as many veterans as you could afford. As you and I talked earlier, we do understand that it's going to be a considerable expense, and we just had the budget forecast, of course, yesterday. So it leaves this committee and stakeholders looking at the variables in the program and what things need to flex. And I might suggest that if we could take input from you, I think the stakeholders would still be, we have a great relationship, be interested in taking your suggestions back and putting them to some language. One of the suggestions in terms of cost drivers and variables that you could consider would be a program cap. Just tell us the amount of money that you're able to deliver to this program, and we could recraft it by altering some of the variables. As you suggested, we could eliminate the graduate school option. We could also limit it. Right now, it covers housing, tuition, and fees. We could just reduce it to tuition and fees. So there's lots of room for maneuvering. So it's up to this committee, I think, to give us some instruction, but we'd be happy to continue to work together and put language together at your recommendation.
Okay. Well, I would be most comfortable with an overall program cap. We have one program that we oversee, which is the state grant program, which is an open appropriation. And although the Office of Higher Education is getting much better at predicting how much that is, we still, you know, we're dealing with surpluses, and in the past we were dealing with deficits, and it can be very, I think, detrimental to a program to not have kind of certainty. If we had an overall program cap, you would be in a situation where it would be kind of first come, first served. So the veterans that are in there and they apply for the money, it's kind of like we have, Senator Roebling, remember we put in deadlines for applications to just kind of control the program? It's similar to that. If we could do that, but, you know, that this would be even more controlling as if we had a cap. And if we had a $10 million cap or whatever dollar amount we set that at, than the veterans who applied. But what it would mean, though, is that if more were applying after the cap and they had to wait a year, then we would know maybe we needed to adjust the cap on the program, that there was enough demand for it. But we really, at this point, we don't know the demand because as I've looked at the bill, if you're eligible for Pell Grant, that's first, and then the state grant comes in, and then the GI Bill comes in, the federal money. And only after those, and if we limit it to tuition and fees, and we also could limit it to the, what's that thing we just called, the tuition cap.
Public school cap.
The tuition cap that we have in law, the $10,000, because we do want to still have choice in the system. I mean, some people said to me you could limit it to just public institutions, but I think you solve the same purpose by continuing to have a tuition cap. Right. But yet GIs could choose to go to St. Thomas or Augsburg or wherever they wanted to go for their program. Anyway, I would like to hear from the members and advice you might have as to how we might structure this program. Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I had a bill that just concluded. But on the discussion of the amount that's eligible, you mentioned tuition and fees. Would that also include textbooks?
He's the textbook guy. Yes, it should include fees. I would argue fees cover textbooks, but maybe not. It should include books.
If there needs to be a friendly amendment, then it's clear.
I don't think we have that even in front of us, that kind of a limiting.
Madam Chair,
Senator Mr. Wieger, Mr. Connors.
The cost of attendance would include books and textbooks as part of that. If you were to limit it to tuition and fees, then you would have to be very specific about textbooks being included.
We'd say cost of attendance. Correct.
Madam Chair?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I don't know who would know the answers to this question, so I'll just throw it out there. Do you have any idea what proportion of the adult population in 1945 had bachelor's or higher degrees, and what proportion of the adult population now has bachelor or higher degrees?
Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, I don't have percentages, but just an interesting historical fact that I think will also answer your question. So when the federal GI Bill was presented, it was quite controversial in its day because the congressmen were actually arguing quite a bit about if they give the newly returned veterans money that they maybe will slack off and not get back to work because they'll be going to college. And the other part of that equation, I think, speaks to how many people in the nation had college degrees at the time. There was also quite a bit of controversy because the veterans were being given the opportunity to get their degrees at a time when degrees were really limited to the wealthy. So I think the number of people at the time, proportionately speaking, the percentage is quite small compared to today.
I'm sure this came up at our workshop on Friday. Does anyone remember in Minnesota what percentage of adults have bachelor degrees? Is it like, I want to say 35%?
I think that's what they told us, Madam Chair.
Yeah, we're trying to find it, too. That's
Madam Chair, I think it's in the range of 25%.
25% that
believe.
Low? Can you
it might
believe
be
20, that?
25 to 28.
Maybe, Madam Chair, it might have been with degrees, or so it could have been AA degrees, too. I thought it was one-third.
Are you thinking of two-year, four-year, Senator Latz?
Whatever would be covered by the proposed
We're kind of trying to find that information. I'm sure we had it on Friday, if someone remembered. Oh, okay. Just an announcement, the university is closing at 2:30, so there's not going to be any State of the University today. So we're off the hook.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Sort of a follow-up corollary to this. My recollection of the history that I learned on the GI Bill is very limited, so correct me if I'm wrong. But I understand one of the reasons for it was because they had a massive return of people who didn't necessarily have anything that they would go do. There was going to be an issue of displacing a lot of the female workers that had come into the workforce in heavy industry in order to support the war. And so there was a concern about making sure people had something to do. The other thing was there was a recognition of the value of higher education, and this is a very ready pool of people that didn't already have jobs lined up that could go into higher education. So there was a great incentive to build the economy and build the knowledge base in the economy. And I'm wondering if, number one, that might be off base, but that's my recollection, if we are in the same kind of a situation now, as opposed to all the other kinds of support, public financial support for higher education that already exists in the system, independent of a supplement to the federal GI Bill. And part of this segue is because I actually had a veteran, a member of the legislature, whom I won't name, but who once suggested to me that he was concerned with regular efforts on the part of the legislature to send money or other benefits to veterans that the veterans had not anticipated or signed up for when they joined the military. Part of it may just be calling it out as a question of, are we sending stuff the veterans' ways because it's a politically exciting or palatable or beneficial thing to do, as opposed to having a very real and substantial policy basis for doing so. That is a higher priority than the other things that we are doing, which does not at all call into question the dedication and the valor of those who serve our country. Balancing the other priorities, and this came from a veteran to me, I'm wondering where this fits in that context, especially since there already is a federal program, maybe not as generous as we would like it to be or think it ought to be. I know a lot of people who really do try hard can actually graduate from college in 4 years or sooner if they concentrate what they do. Now, I understand the need sometimes for longer periods of time, and that's one of the shortcomings of the federal GI Bill. But we already provide an awful lot of public financial assistance for people to attend school that was not necessarily available in 1945 or thereabouts when the original GI Bill was passed. So why this additional financial effort to support veterans?
I have my own response, but I'll let the panelists respond.
Madam Chair, I'll just respond shortly. My understanding is that both of these bills, Senator Latz, just are like someone said earlier in a meeting today, it's like the glue that fills in between cracks. It is not meant as a first dollar opportunity for our veterans. The GI Bill is there for that. There's state grants, Pell grants. There's all sorts of money available to our National State Guard. What this does is simply update and provide a little bit of an opportunity. It bridges gaps between some of those programs so that we're able to catch our Minnesota veterans who do want to go on for college or higher education who don't qualify for some of those other areas. This is a last dollar in program.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it can help fill gaps, but I understand what Representative Latz is trying to say. And the one thing I do know about veterans is they're very selfless people. And in many ways, if they went in not expecting this, they might even be somewhat embarrassed if it becomes a lavish benefit that they receive that other people wouldn't be able to. So I think they appreciate us making an effort to help them, but I don't think that they are expecting us to take care of everything for their education. And just because that's how veterans are, they serve the public and they serve others. And so it is a gesture of goodwill, certainly. And it certainly can help encourage many of, especially the young people who are coming out. I'm a little concerned that people who have recently retired, especially if we leave the graduate programs in, they're living here probably on military pensions and having other jobs or at least part-time jobs too. They retire oftentimes when they're 38, 40 years old, and they're not financially in need. So I do believe we do have to keep some caps on this program because it isn't financial need-based at all. And we do have a lot of people that have financial needs. So I think what the governor's original proposal was fairly reasonable, but I would agree that with the limited resources we have that to remove caps would not serve the public well.
Well, I'll let you speak in a minute. Remember that we're trying to do this accountability system. And as I recall, this is tied into what Senator Latz said, we have an issue with incumbent workers, is that our incumbent workers are not as educated as they need to be. And these are people who are already in the workforce. So I think this would be very interesting to look at this area if it's right that only a third of our current working population has a bachelor's degree, and I think Dr. Weidman went to find that information. We could look at this in fitting with our accountability work that we're doing, is that we're taking a group of incumbent workers and improving their skill level so that they can add more to the economy in the state. Then I think things like that can kind of help us. I had a question about current state programs for tuition reimbursement for veterans. Who can tell me about the current? I didn't realize that we had a current state tuition reimbursement program. It must be funded out of another pot of money that isn't in my division. Mr. Mann.
Madam Chairman, it's Mr. Med.
Madden?
Med, I'm sorry.
Med, with a D?
M-E-D-D.
Thanks, Mr. Med.
You're welcome.
My ears, I apologize.
In the past, I served with the National Guard, and the National Guard does have a tuition reimbursement program. It was a program instituted in the 80s to recognize the dual role of the National Guard. The National Guard is not only answerable to the president, but they're also on call by the governor, who has called them numerous times for floods, riot control, various other activities. And the reason that the legislature originally granted the National Guard this was to encourage enlistment in the state's source of readily available help in time of emergency. So I believe...
So it's only for the National Guard.
It's only for the National Guard. It reimburses tuition and fees, and I believe it's limited. I think it's capped to the tuition and fees at the U. I retired in 91, so I'm not really up on this anymore, but that's the purpose of it.
And it's state-funded.
It is state-funded, yes. It goes through the Department of Military Affairs.
So if we're...
The soldier is reimbursed. He has to...
Right.
He has to complete the semester. He has to keep in the good graces of his first sergeant, his or her first sergeant, and then he submits a voucher to to his unit, and then the unit submits it to the Department
of
Military.
And is there a limit on how much?
I think there is. He has to be a drilling member, I believe it's 4 years, but I'm not sure of that.
Okay.
We have someone that can answer that question.
Right. Do you want to come up to the table and to the microphone?
Is the issue whether we should put a cap?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Terry Palmer, Department of Military Affairs.
I have to cut this off. Yeah. Mr. Palmer?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome.
I'm not exactly sure of the language. I think it's 144 credit limit. I can check on that and get back to you, though, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. So total, how many years is that then? 3 years? 2 years?
It's a four-year degree.
It's a four-year degree. Okay. And so you can go part-time, full-time. You just get reimbursed.
Correct.
Okay. So in the legislation, did you take that into account in the legislation? No, you did not. So can people who apply for this program kind of double dip?
We just discovered this aspect this morning.
Okay.
And there's, I tell you, the veterans eligibility and programming that's out there is very, very detailed. And we were just discussing it this morning. So there is some opportunity to continue to draft language to deal with this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Palmer. And there was Ben from the AG's office. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. I didn't get to call on you. Your last name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Wogsland. I'm the Assistant Director of Communications for the Attorney General's Office. And I'd just like to speak a little bit towards the need of the program, as was discussed by Senator Latz. I think we've got a great federal program, the GI program, that has 4 years of benefits. But in some cases, this program doesn't go far enough for certain individuals. For young people that come back and can afford to go to school full time, the program is great, and a lot of times people can graduate in 4 years. For some people, however, if you come back and maybe have kids or a mortgage or have a financial situation that only allows you to go to school part-time, you may not be able to graduate in 4 years. You may have a year, year and a half left, or whatever it is. This program the proposal that was put out by the Attorney General for full tuition benefits once you've exhausted state and federal programs would fill in those gaps and allow those people to graduate. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is if we keep the cost of the tuition and fees and perhaps books as well We're basically modeling this bill in the language after what's already in place in the state of Wisconsin and has been for a couple of years. And Illinois also has a similar program that's been up and running for about 5 years. Both of these states offer full tuition benefits to veterans and service members that have exhausted other benefits in order to help them graduate. And based upon the cost in those states, we've cost estimated our program under $15 million per year, and we believe that, that we as a state can make that investment and that it's an important investment to make, and would favor something along the lines of, as you mentioned earlier, of a cap on the program or something along those lines to make sure that we are, you know, putting the program out there and we can see how popular it is and how successful it is and evaluate it. But we strongly believe that it's important to get give full benefits to those people so that they're not just paying for one class or something along those lines. Thank you.
Well, it does seem to me that there's some new information and some new ideas on the table. If the National Guard that are serving, if they already can get reimbursed, then that certainly cuts the universe, because this is more of a grant system rather than a reimbursement system. But in, you know, unless whoever has the money for the reimbursement program transfers it to my division, you know, I don't want to double fund here. I don't know if that's in the Veterans Committee or where that is. So it just seems to me that you guys need to do a little bit more work. We definitely want to do something, so I think we can move to lay it over for possible inclusion. But we do need to get all the facts on the table, the correct fiscal note. So once if the direction you want to go in is to cap the program but not the individual benefit, fine. If you want to do both, cap the individual benefit. You know, I might want to cap the program anyway, but you should think about capping the individual benefit. I mentioned that I thought maybe we didn't need to pay for graduate school. That's very, very expensive. And certainly if you're already eligible for tuition reimbursement, then you should not be eligible for this. You know, grants might be nicer than reimbursement, but if we already have that in place.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Our Commissioner of Veterans Affairs is here, and he might be able to clarify a few more things for us if we could bring him up.
Okay. Great. Hi. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Clark Dyrud, Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. I'd just like to speak to a couple of the issues. We have been part of the discussion for quite some time. Just like to clarify couple of points. First of all, the original proposal called for a $1,000 cap per semester. And this was very much supported by people from the veterans community as well as our department and higher ed. The idea being that it would be something for the veteran that needed help with the last dollar in, as well as someone who didn't need any state grants. If a cap is removed, now we are talking about probably skewing towards someone who doesn't have much financial need. If you're just saying tuition reimbursement, someone who qualified for Pell grants, state grants, etc., those needs would be met, and someone who didn't qualify would have tuition reimbursement. So the idea was last dollar in. $1,000 per semester. It would be eligible for private colleges, University of Minnesota, Minskew system, the tech colleges, you know, the 8-month courses. It would be universal. It would be $1,000 per semester. And so that was a consideration. There's a $15 million.
Regardless of need.
Yes.
Right.
You're correct.
Limiting it to just your tuition.
Either. Exactly.
Right. So if you, it could go toward living expenses.
Right.
So just was
the birth of the 1.2 factor, because if you just go with cost of living, the neediest veterans, cost of attendance, straight cost of attendance, our neediest veterans could qualify for Pell grants and state grants and not be eligible for anything. So this is the factor of 1.2, raises that limit, and the neediest veterans would probably qualify for $1,000. Because the cost of attendance, as you probably know, isn't actually an accurate cost. It usually costs a little bit more. And I think the universities and colleges tell that to their students. So I think that's somewhat clearly understood. So
would there still be some veterans that wouldn't qualify, even with the 1.2 addition to the cost of attendance? Or why are we even having this at all? Or is there still a limit? Like would some get less than $1,000 per semester, based on all the other aid packages?
Madam Chair, that is a possibility.
Okay.
The other factor we'd like to discuss is the comparison to Illinois and Wisconsin. I don't know if that's entirely accurate right now. We know, for example, that Illinois has something of a tuition waiver in place so that some of the institutions have to absorb that cost. Don't know all the details. We know that Wisconsin uses the federal GI Bill less than we do. We know that last year, the one figure that anyone knows is the total number of veterans drawing the federal GI Bill. Mm-hmm. That's the only solid number. The rest are projections. We know that last year, 6,700 people used federal GI Bill in Minnesota. We know that 5,500 used it in Wisconsin. We know that that's in Minnesota, that's 2% of our veterans population use the GI Bill. 1% in Wisconsin use the GI Bill. We can discuss reasons, et cetera, et cetera. But that's what's important is that we know that's the only solid number that we have. So we are projecting the usage of this. And thus, with a cap of $1,000, the original language called for an annual limit of $15 million, $30,000 for the biennium.
There was a cap on the original?
Yes, okay. Yes, $30 million for the biennium.
Are veterans who already have a bachelor's degree still eligible?
Yes, they would.
For something other than graduate school, like to get a different degree, or only for graduate school?
Yes. Madam Chair.
Mr. Med.
They would be eligible for the $10,000. So they would be eligible under both bills for a second bachelor's degree if that was what they desired.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I'm glad you asked that last question because there's another concern. If we want our veterans to have degrees, mm-hmm. then let's help them get degrees. But second degree or a third degree? Every dollar that we would put into this is not being paid for necessarily by all the taxpayers of the people of Minnesota. It's being paid for an opportunity cost or a dollar cost by other potential recipients of public financial aid to attend higher education.
Right.
So every kid in the Rondo neighborhood that would not be able to afford school because there's not enough money in the state grant program would not be able to get additional money in the previous proposed bill to help them attend school if we put some money into this program. The Office of Higher Education is proposing, as part of the rulemaking process, an interest holiday for veterans during their deployment. But that would come out of, that would be paid for by the other students that are paying interest on their loans, because that's a self-contained fund. That's where the finances comes for that. There's a proposal floating around the legislature to give veteran retirees, I think, to waive state income tax entirely for veteran retirees who continue to reside in Minnesota. There is a opportunity cost for every dollar that we do here. And I think, and these are the hard questions I think that we as a committee may not want to have to struggle with, but I think we have a fiduciary obligation to struggle with these questions, how do we turn to the student in Rondo or the student in Hutchinson whose parents don't make very much money and they really want to go to college and they just can't put all the pieces together without enough other financial aid, whether it's in the form of reducing tuition or reducing tuition increases, or whether it's on money on the formula, you know, with assigned student responsibility or the LME or wherever you put the additional resources. You know, how do you tell them that we couldn't put that extra $10 or $15 million into that program because we're going to put money into this program for people who might already have BAs or for people who might otherwise, you know, are not otherwise distinguished financially from those potential applicants except by virtue of the fact that they carry veteran status. And again, they've earned their veteran status and all of the credit and applause and thankfulness that we as a public can give them for that service. But the question is, should we be giving them the additional financial resources here in addition to all the other places that we already do, to the detriment, candidly, of the others who might otherwise qualify for funds that won't be there because this is where we chose to fund? I think that's the hard question that we as a committee have to struggle with, especially when our portion of the allocation for the overall budget is being reduced from at least the initial request. So I lay the questions out because I think we've got to deal with them. I'm glad that we've had a chance to have some of this discussion, Madam Chair.
And that's because Health and Human Services wants more and K-12 wants more. Well, and Larry wants to pay special ed.
All worthy uses of the dollars. But that leaves us with very limited dollars, Madam Chair. And I think we have an obligation to set priorities. And I think the hard question we have to ask is the status of an individual as a veteran, is that a sufficiently high priority to displace others who have the same level of financial need that we would not be able to fund as a result?
Probably greater.
Or greater level of financial need.
Commissioner Dyrud, do you have any, can you tell me what the age range we should expect this veteran class to be?
Madam Chair, the starting date would be August 2nd, 1990. Mm-hmm. So it is conceivable that someone getting out of the service at that time would be maybe 40 years old. So using that as a starting point, there was some discussion, and by the way, I would like to point out that this Minnesota GI Bill is part of a bigger discussion of veterans' issues. And that was the rationale for a cap to begin with. As Senator Latz points out, there is limited dollars. So there are several needs in the veterans' community. So the Minnesota GI Bill originally did have a cap in there, and those type of issues were considered.
Just our earlier question discussion we were having about how many people in our state have bachelor's degrees, the data that we found very quickly is from 2000, so it's pretty old data. But the number of Minnesotans 25 and over with a bachelor's degree or higher was 27%. 27%, that's really low, but it's 10th highest nationally. Now, if we go with a younger cohort, age 25 to 34, then 35% of them have a bachelor's degree or higher. Fifth highest in the nation. So we look good nationally, but that's still a very low number for bachelor's degrees. So I think, you know, this is one of our big challenges because people 25 to 34 are going to be in the workforce a long time. And they're not going to have the skills that they need for our economy. They need to be upgrading their skills. So this is really a good group to really focus on in terms of upgrading their training, and if it happens to be veterans that we focus on, then that's a good group to start with. Senator Lynch, I was waiting for you to weigh in here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Rokes. First, I appreciate the comments made by Senator Latz. So I just want to thank you for bringing the discussion to this area. It seems to me, just generally, I'm supportive of the inclusion of caps in this. I think it also pertinent that we consider and remember two things. One, we have to keep it in perspective, to keep the discussion in perspective, I think it's really important to remember that this is not the end-all be-all for the veterans in terms of education. And so I think that it's important to really take a look at what the other opportunities, what the other options, what the federal program does as we have to look at this in our really limited resources. And the other thing that I've picked up on today is that there are a number of provisions being debated in this very body regarding veterans. And so I would encourage the committee and the chair to take a look collectively at all of those things, recognizing that not all of those veteran benefits are being funded from this division, but as a state and as a Senate, as a body, that we look collectively at what we're proposing to put together for that group. So that would be my hope of a direction that we would want to take.
Well, we have some work ahead of us, and I'm going to call on Senator Wieger, and then we're going to move on. Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, just a few comments on the record. I want to first thank Governor Pawlenty and Attorney General Swanson for their leadership, bipartisan leadership. There's been some discussion as to whether we're putting one group against another. Let's distinguish the fact that this group put their life on the line. 50-some Minnesotans went to the altar of freedom already. Hundreds disabled. The impact on families. And now we are looking at the largest return of vets over the next few months. There's a clear distinction. Senator Latz mentioned, well, did the veteran anticipate this benefit? Well, I don't think they knew about this potential benefit. They probably knew there was some college involved. But once you're in boot camp and going through your MOS, your training, and getting things together, you're not thinking about what the legislature might be contemplating. But you also, you're putting your entire life and your loved ones on the line. When people come back members, you think it's just a 4 years, you finish, use up your 36 months, your GI Bill, and everything's clean, and you know, take a full load. You know, talk to some veterans and find out what it's like to return home. And you'll know it's not that easy. If they can graduate in 5 years, that's great. And what if they want to go to graduate school? Great. I have one constituent I'd like to refer to, and you probably know who it is, who's been totally independent financially since ninth grade. And she is in about month 31 or 32 in that GI Bill after returning from Iraq, and now dreams of being a social worker, Mankato State University. But to be employable, she'll need to get that master's degree. She lives check to check, like a lot of veterans. Like a lot of veterans that called yesterday at the end of the month to hope to get that wire transfer in 7 to 10 days for that GI Bill, hoping that it's going to be there. It's not always there. But that will exhaust for a lot of veterans. So if they want to continue that, you know, we have to empower them, and they need it. It's not a wealthy group. It's a humble group. They're not here. You have Commissioner Dyrut and others that are speaking for them. And as a parent, I'm speaking on that person. That's my daughter.
I'm glad she's back.
And I know a lot of her friends. And for those soldiers, they need this. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Madam St. John. Madam
Chair, I think I perhaps taken, and appropriately so, by the testimony I just heard from
my good friend Senator Wigger, and I would just like the record to show that I agree entirely with what his comments were. I think freedom's not free. These people have played an enormous price for us. I think it's our turn to do all that we can to support them. And I concur 100% with his comments.
And on that, Senator Lynch moves that Senate file 408 be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Ropes, did you want to say something?
Just one last thought. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, and Senator Wigger and Senator Senjum. Just to remind the committee as well, continuing on their thoughts, that today's veteran coming back from Afghanistan or Iraq or Iran or serving Minnesota in the National Guard is typically 10 years older than the one that was served when the GI Bill began. These are usually married people, sometimes have children, they have mortgages, they have car payments, and this will go a long way to help. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Roebling, we want to have time to talk about ACHIEVE now.
Yes. Madam Chair, it's Article 3 in the Higher Ed Bill. And
starts on what page?
On page 25.
And what we thought we would do today, Senator Roebling, is because the governor's initiative is really around the idea of preparation for college, we thought we'd get just a little review, as well as talking about the program, of what are some of our college intervention programs are. And I know when we visited the Office of Higher Education, we did talk about some of those at that time. So if you want to start, I need a little.
Madam Chair, I am rather excited about this proposal because I think it provides two things that we're really looking for, that we know we need to improve student access and student readiness for higher education. I believe that by providing financial scholarships to students who take courses that prepare them for college or that they actually can get college credit for while still in high school is a great incentive for them to take those courses. I know that high school students value money, and they can be motivated by it, which is why we have almost all of our high school students working in some jobs or in some capacity. And so I think that this will be attractive to them, and so that will be a great incentive. And the double bonus out of it is that when they take those courses, they will be more likely to be prepared and ready for the rigors of college, which will help us deal with that whole issue of remediation. And hopefully we won't need to do that. We will address it in high school before they get their high school diploma, so we don't have to address it when they get to college. And so it serves a double purpose. And I'll let Susan Hegard go through the details of the proposal.
Thank you. My name is Susan Hegard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I'm joined by Mark Mishkanis, who's our director of fiscal policy and research, and he and I are going to tag team on this. This, of course, is a revised proposal from the one that the governor initially introduced. That proposal was geared towards the top 25% of the high school class. The income cap was higher, and it had a really quite a different focus. This revised proposal, I think Senator Roebling has summarized it nicely. It's really focused on a much broader range of students, to provide them with a broad cross-section of college experiences. I'll just walk briefly through some of the criteria. You have to be a Minnesota resident, enrolled in one or more rigorous high school courses. The family income must be less than $100,000. Minnesota public, private, and proprietary higher education institutions may participate. The way that we'd worked up the funding based upon the overall appropriation number, and I'll ask, we have a point to make on the appropriation, which Mr. Canis will follow up on. But in the proposal, we'd set aside designated $314 for each rigorous high school course. Basically, our office would oversee the program. And so when the student was done with their high school education and had proof of graduation and the rigorous courses, we would then make an amount available to that student based upon the course taking that they could use at the college and institution of their choice. This funds would be available for the first 4 years after high school. And the range of programs, as I mentioned, is quite broad. AP, IB, post-secondary enrollment options, college-level examination program, college in the schools, concurrent enrollment, and then work-based learning programs as well. And I think it just follows well with many of the discussions that we've been hearing about trying to get students more college opportunities, a broad cross-section of students, not our highest achievers, but our students of all income levels who can so that we can give them some more opportunities.
Madam Chair, members, okay. Mark, for the record, Mark Michikanis, Boston for Higher Education. Just one point on the appropriation and the cost. The appropriation of the bill is $46 million a year, or 92 for the biennium. We had done some further analysis, and admittedly there were some errors in communications at some point in the process. The cost is, of the bill as it's before you is about $39.5 million.
For the biennium?
No, that's per year relative to the 46. So it's cheaper by roughly $6.5 million.
There was one other point, Madam Chair, that two points actually that I wanted to make. One was to give some credit to the Private College Council. This proposal was built in part on something that they had suggested a while back, and we thought that it had quite a bit of merit. So I wanted to make sure credit is given where credit's due. And then also at our workshop last Friday, you'd talked. The leaders talked with us about the Indiana 21st Century Scholars Program. I made a side by side, just a quickie. Side-by-side at our office that I made available to Ms. Weidman. But that program is quite a bit different than the one that we're talking about, although I think it's important for you to know that the governor is very willing to talk about options. I think his goal is to really see some way of trying to give students some leverage and opportunities for college, and he'd like to see that happen sooner rather than later. Thank you.
Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Yes, on page 26, line 26.18, there's a reference made in terms of eligibility. Be a United States citizen or eligible non-citizen as defined thus and such. And I'm interested to know if there are eligibility, what the parameters are. I'm not understanding what that eligible non-citizen really pertains to.
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling.
I think since this is being treated as a form of financial aid, and in our current law, that is one of the requirements to get a state grant, that it's being treated the same way.
Okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, the reference on lines 18 there, those are the legal non-residents, legal citizens, they'd be refugees and people that have been into the country legally.
Okay.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question?
Senator Sharon.
I may not have gotten this as you were going through it. Is there a limit to the number of courses that a student can take and get credited for this $314 towards a college tuition? Is there any limit to that?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, no, there is no limit. I think the governor was very specific that he wanted to make sure you could take at least one, but the cap, there's no cap on the other side.
What happens if schools don't offer any AB or IB or college in the schools? There isn't a post-secondary institution close by? Because last night at the hearing, Representative Poppy said several times when the young woman was talking about IB, I think, that she doesn't have that in her school.
Madam Chair, I'll first speak to that. One of the things I think that's a very good point that we need to do is a better job of trying to make these options available to students throughout Minnesota. It shouldn't be available to students in the metropolitan area and in geographic centers. We need to make it more broadly available. I know there are funds available. You know, that the Department of Education is doing some outreach on AP and IB. I don't know if you have anything else that you wanted to add.
Senator Roebling.
Online courses would also be eligible. Mm-hmm. So that would be another option for students who wouldn't have it available at their school. They could actually enroll in a post-secondary class online, and they could get credit for that as well.
Is there a charge for that?
Madam Chair, this also, maybe this would provide some incentive for colleges to try to provide in schools some of these opportunities for students.
since we talk a lot about college preparation in our division, because certainly we, in terms of the accountability issues, we certainly know that students have to come to college prepared. But last night was actually fairly unusual that we actually had a whole hearing, and most of the things we talked about were really K-12 issues, getting kids ready for college. You know, and I really believe in P16, but right now that's not the way we fund programs. Maybe we should, but we're not. And so why should this be funded in this division and not in the K-12 bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I think one of the points this program is intended to prepare students for college, but also to help them pay for college. And that's why the governor put it in as a higher education budget item.
Do we know how many kids currently are taking these kind of rigorous courses?
Madam Chair, we do have a list of some of these from the Department of Education. I think the number, I'm going to take a guess, it's in the range of 25,000 courses annually.
25,000 students?
Courses. So some students may be taking more than that.
One in one course.
But I would like to actually go back to the data source and to confirm that. Madam Chair, one other point about the list of courses themselves. I think when we struggle with this issue about maybe we should pay for rigorous courses, but trying to define that in a way that's comparable across the state is very, very difficult. So you end up with courses like this because they're easily identifiable. You quantify them. You know when you take them. So it's a balance between trying to, I think, get to the right point that you're talking about and being able to actually measure it.
How did you pick the number of 100,000 adjusted family adjusted gross income? I mean, that doesn't sound like that's your typical low-income family. And my concern would be, are we just paying kids to take these courses that are going to take them anyway? You know, and go to college anyway. You know, what kind of bang for our buck are we going to get here?
Madam Chair, the governor had originally, in his first proposal for ACHIEVE, had $150,000 family income cap. So he wanted to bring it, he was willing to bring it down from that. But I think he felt strongly that it should be available to lower income students, but also reach up into the middle income families. And this could be one family where the income earner is making $100,000 or less, or two income earners who are making $100,000 or less.
Well, currently, any kid can take a post-secondary class and get paid. Those are not means tested, but the high schools pay for it. They do that.
This is on top of it. But Madam Chair, they would get a double benefit because they would get their course paid for as a high school student in the post-secondary program, and they would be eligible for $314 for their second year of college, or for their next year of college after they've graduated from high school. Yeah, they get the credit and the scholarship.
So do we know that there is, if we're real successful, it's almost a victim of our success. If we're very successful, do the schools have the capacity to accommodate students? I mean, last night St. Paul did talk about almost making a rigorous curriculum the default curriculum, that sounds like the direction we should be moving in. I just wonder if we're there yet. Can we be there? How soon we can be there? I don't know because I'm not on K-12 anymore, so I'm kind of worried about the capacity of schools to accommodate this.
Madam Chair, I'm not. I don't work in the K-12 area anymore either, but I end up talking about K-12 often, but I think we set lots of expectations now for students, and I suppose this is an expectation or a goal for schools, that we would like to see them, if there's demand, we'd like to see them move towards where the demand is,
and
changing behavior.
Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling.
I think that if students and their families are aware of this program and their school isn't offering many of these courses within their own system, there's kind of a consumer demand that will be placed on, which will help raise the level of courses in the schools too. The school boards will hear about this and say, the parents will be saying, and the students, we expect more of these courses to be available so our students can take advantage of it. And so I think it kind of raises the level, raises the bar a little bit on what will be available because there will be a demand for it.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that, I'm sitting next to two rural members last night, Representative Rukavina and Representative Poppy, and they're both saying, Representative Rukavina, I felt like I might have hurt myself in terms of the attitude towards St. Paul, because it sounded too rich. You know, five languages and IB and AB and all this stuff, and we're a poor school district. You know, we need more money. And my colleagues in the rural area are saying, well, we don't have that. We have one language now in our school, Spanish. We don't have IB and AB. We don't have that. And the only answer I really came up with was numbers, is that when you have 2,000 kids in a school, you are able to fund these different things because you're going to have a critical number of kids that are going to be able to take it. Whereas in a rural school, that's not the case. You don't have the numbers to be able to do that unless you do online and, you know, things like that. But I don't know that they have the capacity to do this, because I think the demand has been out there for a while. So anyway, maybe that was more a comment than a question. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Roebling. Two things. One, I represent five school districts, I believe. None of the five school districts that I represent have IB programs. There are varying degrees of AP offerings in the school districts that I represent. I come to the Senate from a school board, and I like to think it's a larger school district, and I'm referencing the Rochester School District here in this case. And in terms of AP offerings, I have been in numerous conversations where we share the governor's desire to increase that rigor, and certainly those AP offerings. I will tell you quite candidly that we have felt quite limited in our ability to increase our AP offerings because of funding. It's not because we didn't believe it was best for kids, or not because we didn't want to support rigor and raise the bar. But so that's a real concern. And then I'm just going to switch gears quickly and just more as a note. I really believe that the very best incentive, the best tool that we can give our students at any income level in Minnesota is affordable tuition. And I think I jotted down that this program is $39 million a year. Yes. And so I just entertain $39 million a year could be spent in this fashion, or I'm a proponent of supporting those things that we can do to really make tuition affordable in all of our institutions.
Senator Roebling.
I understand Senator Lynch's concern, but this, like I said, has a dual purpose: to help pay for college, but to also motivate students to be prepared for college. And if we could do that, I would venture to say that students right now are spending at least $39 million a year in remedial work. Mm-hmm. And so if we could avoid that, this would be well worth the money. And so I we have to try and figure out how to make sure that they're coming to school prepared.
We only have a half hour left. I think I have a bunch of questions that I'm going to submit to you in writing to the office to see if you can help us understand the program more. And then I think we may have to revisit it when we're putting the bill together, because I really want to get more of a sense of what's out there, because maybe a better approach might be to just kind of support what we're already doing. We have a tendency, I think, around here to forget the successful things we've been doing for the last 10 years because we never bring them to scale, but then we jump on the new hot idea, which we want to do full-fledged rather than try it out.
Madam Chair, I think one point, though, I would make is that this does build on some of the things that are working. We weren't trying to create new programs. It's something that pulls together some of the programs that have been around for quite some time and build on those, but then just offer students some financial incentive so that they can help pay for college. And then the one point I just wanted to make to Senator Lynch is that,
I don't disagree. You know, money is tight, and it's we want to try to provide lower tuition. But at the same time, you know, back in this report that we released last week, you know, we're in the middle of the pack on a lot of measures. And the better prepared our students can be, the better off we're going to be as a state and as a country. So, you know, it's tough, but I do think that it's important to try to provide more opportunities for kids regardless of where they live. And we've all got to be more innovative.
Would this scholarship affect their other state grant, the Pell Grant, the state grant?
No, it comes in after. I think.
Madam Chair, there's no provision in the bill to integrate them at this point.
But if you get a scholarship from anywhere else, or an institutional scholarship, is that over and above your Pell Grant and your state grant?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's always the last dollar, if you will.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much. We do need to have more discussion on this, but I maybe shouldn't have invited all these wonderful people to come and talk, but they're here, and I want to hear from them. So we have the Get Ready program. Why don't you come up? Intervention for College Attendance program. Why don't you start, since you're both Office of Higher Education programs, and I can only give you, like, 5 minutes each.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Lou Dressbach. I'm the Director of Community Outreach and the Get Ready, Gear Up program that our office administers. One of my colleagues, Tricia Grimes, is distributing a handout. I'm going to walk through it very quickly. A number of you were at our office at another meeting and you've heard some of this before, and then I'll be happy to entertain questions if you have them. The Get Ready program is primarily funded under a federal Gear Up grant, and the grant stands for Gaining Early Awareness and Readiness for Undergraduate Programs. It targets low-income students, the students that participate in the program. The schools either have to be 50% or more free and reduced lunch, or the students that we are working with have to be free and reduced lunch students. In all actuality, the schools that we are providing services to are mostly 90% or more free and reduced lunch.
Mr. Esbeck, how much federal money do you get for the program?
That information is on the second page of the handout. We're in a second grant that the agency has, and we are receiving $2.5 million per year for a total of $15 million over 6 years. And the federal grant has to be matched dollar for dollar as far as the grant goes. And the match can be funds, monetary match, or in-kind match. And the most of our matches that we receive are in-kind. The state does appropriate $184,000 per year to the Get Ready program. And we actually use that money, some of that money, to target students that maybe are at schools that are 49% free and reduced lunch, so they're under the eligibility for federal funds, but we can assist those other students that we might not be able to assist with the federal monies. There are two primary goals of the federal Gear Up program. One is that the students graduate from high school, and the second goal is that they enroll in a post-secondary institution upon graduation. Our program has a curriculum that we've developed. We have an elementary curriculum and a middle school curriculum. We start working with students in fourth grade. This year we have students in grades 4 through 8. Next year we will be adding ninth grade to the program. We have staff that work in 8 schools. They work during the day in the schools with the classroom teachers. They do tutoring both during the day and after school, primarily in the areas of reading and mathematics, because those are the key areas that they need assistance with. We have parent events, and with the elementary curriculum, we have parent guides that we've developed. They're just very small publications that parents can use to reinforce the concepts that we're trying to cover in the curriculum that we use. We invite parents on field trips to post-secondary institutions. Many of the parents of the students that we work with have never ever been on a post-secondary institution campus of any sort. We take students to all different kinds of post-secondary institutions throughout the time that they work and get ready so that they understand that there are different options for them. We provide summer scholarships up to $300 for students to attend summer academic camps, and we're very fortunate that we have a number of camps that have partnered with us that the cost of those camps are way beyond $300, and they give our students a scholarship to cover the rest of the cost of those camps. We have a this year we've started an academic advising position in one of our middle schools, and this person is working very closely with the school counselors and actually is meeting one-on-one with students to make sure that they, and it's a St. Paul school, it's at Cleveland or at Washington, and in St. Paul they have a six-year plan, which was talked about last night at the hearing, and this individual sits down with the students and makes sure that they're on track, that they're taking the classes they need to take, that they're turning in assignments. If they see a high level of absenteeism, they talk to the students why that's happening. In one case, a student was late to school. She told our staff person she doesn't have an alarm clock and her mother is gone by the time she has to get up for school. So the staff person bought her an alarm clock.
Simple.
And her on time and absence from school has greatly decreased.
Ms. Dresbach, is the Gear Up program, is it was it like a federal best practice model or something? Who kind of invented the program?
The program was invented or started under the Clinton administration to address the awareness that the population of our country was starting to change drastically, and the students that don't have this information needed some assistance in trying to get to the level where they actually can qualify for being accepted into a school. So the program dictates that a grantee cannot start working with students any later than seventh grade, because already by the time they reach seventh grade, many students have already started to leave school, unfortunately.
Do you have I'm going to interrupt your presentation because I really have questions, and I think now that you've passed this out to me, I remember your presentation at our field trip.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had other schools that have requested that you bring a Gear Up program to their school?
Yes. And that's why we started we have an outreach component to our program, and we don't have staff in those schools, but we have schools located throughout the state, and we have a staff person that meets with the teachers in that school. We provide the curriculum. Our staff person goes through the training, gives them information about financial aid and the curriculum, is on call for the teachers to contact them. We provide lesson plans. And then we will arrange a trip to a post-secondary institution and pay the cost of transportation to that institution in their geographic area.
How do you evaluate success?
Well, right now, the oldest students that, because we started in fourth grade with the initial group, our oldest students are only in ninth grade. So mm-hmm. we're tracking them as far as, are they still in school? Are they, you know, making academic progress? What is their reading level?
Is there any data from other Gear Up programs that, were there others that started sooner than that?
No, we are the only program that has started in fourth grade. We have the youngest start time of any of the programs. There are a few programs that start in sixth grade. The majority of the programs start in seventh grade because that's dictated by the federal grant.
And do we have any statistics from those programs in terms of has there been like a comparison of peer groups to see if they're more successful in graduating, et cetera?
The programs
that are... We have a graduation weight problem with these kids.
Right. Obviously, it varies from state to state. Different programs operate differently. They have different kinds of interventions with their students.
Well, you got your funding renewed, so the federal government must have thought you were doing something right. I mean, I'm trying to...
Yes.
Just how did they evaluate you, your
success? Well, they look at the... We have an annual report that we have to submit to them. Unfortunately, it's not very user-friendly. It collects just basic information about progression in school, the kinds of courses. They've added components now where we have to report on how many students are taking algebra, how many are taking trigonometry, how many are taking
pre-calc. So it's that kind of thing. Are they taking the hard courses?
Yes.
Right.
And also, are they moving from grade level to grade level? Mm-hmm. And
that's an accomplishment.
And truancy, absenteeism. A large factor in the students that, you know, and families we're dealing with, mobility is a huge issue. Just trying to keep track of the students because they will move from school to school maybe 6 times during a school year. So that's
Could we get a copy of that? We don't have to have it for the whole committee, but...
A copy of our last
Of your report to the federal government?
Certainly.
Because Dr. Weidman can figure it out. The rest of us don't want to see it, but she'll figure it out.
Also, our program is constructing longitudinal studies to make some comparisons because we do have some students that we started this year and last year in seventh grade, and we want to compare to see what differences, if any, the effect is between starting them in fourth grade and working with them versus starting them later because there are more programs that have a tendency to start either in junior high or senior high, and they're wonderful programs, but the information is oftentimes anecdotal. So we've hired an evaluation manager to do that, and we will be constructing a report that we will be providing to you on an annual basis then so that it'll be a little bit more user-friendly than the federal report, and also we will be measuring things that are outside the requirements of the federal report.
If we were to scale up your program, could you give me an idea, you don't have to do it now, on you know, how much more you could do with what, say, if the state was to even match the federal money or somewhere in that range? Because, I mean, $184,000, I thought maybe you'd just use that for pin money or something. I'm glad you're using it well.
Yes, we could do that.
All right, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Then let's hear from
Senator Roebling. I know that there have been children who have testified on this and the benefit of it, and they really get enthused about the camps. I'm wondering, though, some of them have attended several different camps, and I'm thinking that if they're starting earlier, they may even be eligible for more. Or do you have a limit on them, or do you use them as rewards for participation, for example, in after-school tutoring? I'm just wondering how you use the camps, because they're the more expensive component maybe per individual. Sometimes I'm concerned that we do a lot for some and then we can't do more for a greater number.
We
limit the number of each student can only go to one camp. So one student couldn't go to 5. Now, we do have some students that would go to several if we give them money to do so. But we try to be strategic. The students can go. We have a cluster of camps that we've developed relationships with over the years, and they've been very good to our students. Several of them just block out a couple weeks in the summer, and they take no one but get-ready students. But then there are also other summer camps that operate throughout the state that are in the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership's Summer Camp Guide. And if students identify other camps that they wish to go to, other than the ones that we've developed partnerships with, as long as it has an academic component to it, we will pay up to $300. And oftentimes the camps have other kinds of monies available that are targeted to low-income students. So we've not had a situation where a student couldn't go to camp because it was too expensive. But we have not, for example, had any students request to go to Concordia Language Villages, which is one of the more expensive camps in the state. It's a wonderful camp, but it's not one that we've had a request for yet.
Okay, let's move on to ICAP.
Senator Pappas, community members, my name is Nancy Walters, and I manage the Intervention for College Attendance Program, the state's pre-college program to increase the number of underrepresented students who enroll in and succeed in higher education. This past biennium, we had $446,000 appropriated for each year of the program. The Office of Higher Education received 30 proposals requesting over $1.2 million for each year of the biennium. Through a competitive award process, we awarded 14 grants for outreach services for students in grades 6 through 12. You have a handout, a one-page sheet, that summarizes the outcomes of the project for the first year. That one-page sheet also shows you where our 14 grantees are throughout the state of Minnesota. And if you'll note that our grantees included nonprofit organizations like the Ely Community Resources Organizations, the Women's Intervention for Women's Improvement Association. We included Admission Possible as a nonprofit organization. And we also had grants to our two-year institutions, like Minneapolis Community and Technical College, Lake Superior College, as well as a number of our four-year Minsky institutions, the University of Minnesota, and a couple of private colleges. These 14 grants provided pre-college services to include mentoring, academic counseling, support for parental involvement, academic enrichment, and the funded proposal for all of the grantees, they had to include an academic enrichment component because we recognized that if students were truly prepared for college, they needed to have that strong academic background.
Ms. Walters, of any of the $1.2 million in requests, were any of them disqualified because it wasn't a good idea or a good plan or a good proposal? Or did you have a tough time making a decision because they were all pretty good? Or
the reviewers did have a tough time making the decisions because we received 30 proposals, and for the 14 that were funded, their budgets were cut. We cut about $125,000 from the proposals that were funded.
So you didn't give them their full amount?
We did not give them their full amount. And in addition, if we had had more, they would have liked to have seen four additional projects funded. And those four additional projects would have required about $200,000. So we were not able to fund all of the strong initiatives that the reviewers wanted. And we did that by not funding about four and by reducing the budgets of the 14 awarded grants by about $125,000.
And do you think that, is there a potential to scale this program up? You know, do you do much advertising? You think that not a lot of people hear about it? Or
no,
are we at capacity if we added these other four grants?
No, we're not at capacity. And I continue to get inquiries from people about the availability of money for new projects and inquiries from our current 14 grantees about the possibility of them continuing.
Oh, right.
Because they continue to get inquiries from students and parents and others for continuation. And one example, one of our grantees is the ACT prep program at the University of Minnesota. And his plans initially were to have approximately 150 students this winter. He had over 250 students show up, and he knew that more would come on subsequent Saturdays. So there is a need, and people do hear about it, and people do inquire. And I get phone calls throughout the year with people inquiring about the availability of money.
And you have a mix of public and private colleges as well as community organizations and some public schools.
Yes, we have all of those because the availability of the request for proposals was advertised as best as I can to all possible applicants.
And you said in the local organizations, they have to provide some kind of a match, either cash or income.
It is required 50-50 by
50% or what's the percentage match?
50% or one-to-one match. So they all have to match and
that
they have.
Limit some.
At this point, for the first year from the records, over 600,000.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I have to rush you. I know you had a long presentation, but let's bring up the three college people, Minsky people, and hear from them a little bit about what they're doing in terms of underserved, Mike Lopez, Barbara Reed, and Mary Dietrich. And I understand if members need to leave, you know, it is snowing again. I hate to announce that. Uh-oh. Or maybe it's just windy. Mr. Lopez and did Ms. Reed and
Madam
Ms.
Chair,
Dietrich,
the other two folks were not able to make
they
it.
They didn't make it because of this weather. Okay, great. Well, good, because we need to adjourn soon.
That's fine.
All right. Well, you can just tell us a little bit then.
Oh, great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Mike Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs for the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. The legislative appropriation for the current biennium included funding for a variety of initiatives that the system had brought forward, including services and outreach for underrepresented students. The Office of the Chancellor allocated $1 million in each year of the biennium to be distributed to the campuses through a competitive grant process. During the previous 2 years, the Office of the Chancellor had conducted similar grant competitions, but with much less money, in fact, only about $250,000 in each year, which we'd given out to the campuses for programs. And we actually learned a great deal from the projects that we funded. Probably the most important thing that we learned was that we already have very effective models for underrepresented student outreach and college retention programs, which are the TRIO, Upward Bound, and Student Support Services programs that we have at many of our colleges. The problem with the TRIO programs is that they can't serve all of the students who need these services or who would qualify for these services. In fact, I've had some conversations with Dr. Weidman, which indicates that under current funding levels, the TRIO programs are really only reaching less than 10% of the students who might be eligible for these services based on being first-generation students or low-income students.
Do you know, Maya, how much money we get in total for TRIO in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, members, I believe in 2005 it was about $16 million, if I remember correctly.
That's both public and private schools.
That's
a year.
Yes, that was for the fiscal year.
Sorry, Mr. Lopez.
I do have those totals for fiscal 2005. For fiscal 2005 in the student support services programs, it was about $8 million, including both Minsky institutions, University of Minnesota, and private colleges. Talent Search, about $2 million, and Upward Bound, about $5.5 million.
Madam Chair, I think one of the other issues is that the funding has been relatively flat. I mean, that has been the number for many, many years. And there might have been some minor inflationary increases, but the dollars have been about the same over the years as well as the number of students served.
That's my understanding. Well, the good news was that we didn't have to reinvent the wheel. That is, in putting out our RFPs, we could encourage programs that were similar to TRIO programs or TRIO-like, as we might say. The other important thing we learned from our pilot projects was that there are a number of best practices in college student retention that have been proven to be very effective in helping students to be successful in their studies. And these five best practices that we identified are summer bridge programs, which Upward Bound uses, intrusive or proactive advising, learning communities, supplemental instruction, and either first-year experience or extended orientation programs. So the RFP that we put out in 2005 required that proposals would include at least one, but preferably more, of these best practices in their plan of operation. And we said that programs that were proposed could focus on outreach efforts, as Upward Bound does, or on student retention, as Student Support Services does, or on both of those. We received 29 proposals. We were only able to fund 11. And I've provided brief summaries of these programs for you in the staple document that contains summaries of the 11 funded proposals. I should point out that the evaluation of the proposals was a peer review process. That is, faculty, administrators, staff from the colleges were actually the ones who came up with the recommendations of the projects that would be funded, rather than being solely an internal process within the offices.
Mr. Lopez,
of the Chancellor.
What was the pot of money you were working with?
$1 million in each year. So we established a limit of $100,000 per project, wanting to spread out the funding as much as we could. As I said, you have summaries of the projects here. The two testifiers that I had asked to come were asked to provide more in-depth information about their programs. What I would like to do instead is just focus on a couple of the programs that are in the summaries. The first is a project at Northland Community and Technical College. Now, as I said earlier, we had encouraged projects that were TRIO-like in operation, but we also left the door open for creative and innovative projects that might not be strictly TRIO-like, but that did address significant local needs. Northland responded with a proposal that focused on the need to bring more Native Americans into healthcare careers. The fact is that Native Americans are certainly dramatically underrepresented in higher education, but even more underrepresented in healthcare careers. And so what Northland proposed was a program that would provide outreach to the White Earth Reservation and also make modifications to the nursing curriculum to include culturally relevant components and thereby make healthcare careers more attractive to this population. The results have been phenomenal. During summer of 2006, they operated a cohort of a certified nursing assistant program, the first step toward a bachelor's degree nursing program. 10 of the 12 students enrolled in the project were Native Americans. All 12 of the students successfully completed the program. The program had projected that it would enroll 20 students from the White Earth Reservation in healthcare programs in fall of 2007. In fact, they enrolled more than 60. The program, I think, is something that is really having a significant impact on a very important public issue. The other program that I'd like to talk about, you do have handouts from, and this is the program at Anoka Ramsey Cambridge campus, and these are the colored sheets. The buff colored sheet is the trifold brochure that describes a program, provides some information about it. This program, which is called Aspire, includes both an outreach component that's similar to Upward Bound and a retention component that's similar to the TRIO Student Support Services program. One of the aspects about TRIO programs that I should have also mentioned is that there is a limitation on the number of programs and the locations where they can be funded. The Cambridge campus is not eligible to receive a Student Support Services program because Anoka Ramsey Coon Rapids campus has one. It can only serve students on the Coon Rapids campus and not at Cambridge. So this, or funding similar to this, is really the only option that they have. Well, if you look at the whatever this is, orange salmon colored sheet, it on the side that talks about key components of Aspire, I think you can see get a good idea of the program of operation. It works with high schools. It also works with Workforce Center and ABE to do outreach. There's a program orientation component. There's a summer bridge program, very important, to help students make the transition from high school or work into college so that they'll be prepared for the demands and the challenges of being a full-time college student. Proactive advising. very often students, and particularly students with lower levels of skill, don't want to go for advising. We have to go out and get them, and that's what the proactive or intrusive advising is. We don't wait for you to come to us. We go out, we call you, we require you to come in. There's also a social and cultural component, academic support and tutoring, and learning components. And if you turn the page, it describes the learning community component of the program. These are two courses. The enrollment is limited, so that if you enroll in political science 2202, you also have to enroll in speech 1110. The instructors cooperate. The students have a built-in support group because they see these students over and over. They work jointly in projects. And as you can see, they will make one presentation, but it'll be evaluated jointly by the two instructors, one focusing on the speech aspects, the other focusing on the political science aspects. We found that learning communities are very, very important in helping students establish engagement with the institution, with relevant others, which is very important to retention.
Mr. Lopez, so with $1 million a year, you said you received 21 proposals and funded 11. And this year, Minsky is requesting, is the $12 million a year you're requesting to do the same thing that you're doing here, but just expand it, you know, more campuses, more money, whatever?
Madam Chair, this really is bringing a successful idea to scale. We found that these programs work. What we would do, or what we would plan to do, is take the $12 million. $8 million of that would be, $8 million a year, would be allocated directly to the campuses on a formula basis based on their number, headcount enrollment, of first-generation students and low-income students. And we've already asked the campuses to submit examples of what they would be doing with this funding and also what their objectives would be or their goals in terms of student recruitment and retention. So we would spend $8 million directly allocated to the campuses. Another $4 million a year we would reserve for another grant process. Again, trying to provide incentives for innovative projects, creative projects. We would focus on having many of these programs be, again, TRIO-like, but then recognizing that there are other opportunities out there to meet important local needs that we may not anticipate.
But only to the campuses?
Yes. Yes, we would not spend any of it at the Office of the Chancellor. It would all go out to the campuses.
Okay. Well, I think we have enough understanding. I appreciate it. I just had one more person that I invited, and she's here. Tracy Parmenter made her way through the snow. We want to give her a chance to give us an update on how Admission Possible is doing.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tracy Parmenter, and I am the Chief Operating Officer of Admission Possible. We are a nonprofit organization that operates here in the Twin Cities metro area to help low-income high school students prepare for college. I am joined, actually, by one of my bosses. Lily Mua is a member of our board of directors at Admission Possible, actually also is a former participant in our program who went on to graduate from St. Olaf College and now serves on our board and is here with us today. I'll provide the briefest possible overview of Admission Possible. We currently work with about 1,000 students in 13 high schools in the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Robbinsdale school districts. We're in the first year of a planned expansion of our program that would reach 1,300 students by the 2008-2009 school year. And this expansion is a result of two things. First of all, the tremendous demonstrated need both in the schools that we currently work in and as well as, of course, in all the schools that we're not in. Every year we have hundreds more students apply to participate in our program than we can serve. And this year, as a part of our expansion, we sent out an invitation to 8 additional metro area schools to sort of apply for us to come there. 6 schools responded that they wanted us to come. Our current funding situation will allow us to probably go to 1 additional school for the coming year. So we think we can see not only from the demographic trends, but also from our experience on the ground that the need is there for our services. And we feel confident offering those because of the results that we have been able to demonstrate for our program. You'll see in the materials that are being distributed here some more details about our results. Over the course of the lifetime of our program, 98% of the students that we have worked with have earned admission to college, and our persistence rate at college right now, as of December 2006, when we did our last report, we had over 80% of our students who were persisting in college or had, who had already graduated.
Many at what point do you start working with these kids?
We recruit students at the end of their sophomore year and work with them through their junior and senior years in high school.
So do you find, are they already signed up to take rigorous courses, or is that part of what you have to do with them?
Some are and some are not. It depends on the students that we work with. Most of the students that we serve are good kids, but they're not students who are sort of slam dunks for college when they enter our program. The average GPA of an entering student is about a 3.2, which is about a B-plus average. And the average ACT scores for students, we administer a baseline ACT exam at the beginning of their junior year. Their average score at that time is about a 15, which is the equivalent of about a 700, 750 on the SAT, and puts those students in about the 10th to 15th percentile of all test takers. So we feel that the students that we admit have the potential to go to college, but aren't necessarily on an automatic track there when they enter the program.
Madam Chair,
you don't think that a student that's averages B plus is not automatically on a college track?
A B plus is a pretty good GPA, but I suspect that if you asked most college admissions officers, if they took those two factors together, both the GPA and the ACT score, that they would not be very excited about admitting a student with that kind of profile as they're coming in, mostly because the ACT score is so low, less so than the GPA.
Mm-hmm. I always thought it was the grades you got in high school that were the best predictors of success in college.
The ACT is
a better predictor? Mm-hmm. Definitely. Oh, go ahead. Can you introduce yourself, though, for the tape?
So my name is Lily Moore, and I graduated from St. Olaf as the first class of admission possible students to graduate, which started back in 2001. Yeah. And I mean, I know that when I first entered admission possible, my ACT score was really low. I think I started off at 16. And then throughout the course, my ACT score actually increased, which really gave me the admissions into St. Olaf. And so I think definitely a lot of students, especially in the Twin Cities area here, who are from low income or do not have parents who have already graduated from college or have attended any kind of higher education or just high school itself, I think it really prepares.
And what kind of grades were you getting?
I mean, I was a pretty good student because I was also a part of a trio younger on. But then, and so I knew that, you know, college was probably possible. But then, you know, being a part of Admission Possible, however, really boosted my self-esteem just because I worked on, you know, the college process with an actual individual one-on-one advisor who actually really helped me through the process. And not only just helped me through the process, but really socially helped me connect to college life. And so I think that's really what really helped me because my parents didn't have that capability to talk to me about college or to just, in general, just to really know how to prepare myself.
I was going to ask you then, did you feel like you were better? You might have been thinking that college was in your future, but did Admission Possible help kind of prepare you
Definitely.
For what you'd have to be doing in college?
Definitely. I mean, with my coach, I learned everything from, like, what to do, what not to do, what are the options, what, you know, I can go abroad, I can be a part of residence life or do whatever
And did you graduate in 4 years?
I did.
All right.
I graduated in 4 years.
Well, remember, members, we've talked about that we often get kids into college, but then we don't retain them. Mm-hmm. School. So that's also part of the issue.
And actually, Madam Chair, if I could respond to that as well. I know that the governor's office just recently produced their report on the higher education institutions in this state, and it included a first-year to second-year retention rate for colleges. In going back and looking at the numbers for Admission Possible, with virtually every single institution in that report, our students had higher persistence rates at those schools than the average that they were reporting.
Senator Roebling, did you want to ask something? Or did you disagree with me on the grades versus the ACT? Is that the issue?
I'm sure that was all.
Oh, okay.
I think that the reason the ACT is often reviewed as a way to determine student success in the future is because grades are so variable that it depends which courses the student took. It depends upon things like grade inflation that may be occurring. And so I think that the ACT is just kind of a standard measurement in many cases.
I wanted to make sure people have questions. They go ahead and ask them so we get the questions in before we have to go home in the snow. Okay, so tell me a little bit more about your success rate results. Here we are.
Yes. So as I had previously mentioned, 98% of the students that we have worked with over the course of the lifetime of our program have been admitted to college. 80% of them are persisting. Our first group of students, which was a very small group, just completed their fourth year of college. That was the group that Lily was in. And we had about 35% of our students who graduated from that group in their first 4 years with an additional about 35% who are continuing to persist in college but have not graduated yet at this point.
So, and what is your capacity in terms of scaling up? You said that there are a bunch of schools that were interested in having you come, but you work with mostly AmeriCorps
students? We do. We use AmeriCorps members to work in the schools with students, as Lily was describing her coach. We have 44 AmeriCorps members who work with us this year. Those are the people who work in the schools. Our main constraining factor at this point, which you probably hear many times in this chamber, is funding. We feel like we have a model that works, and we have the need that exists there, and we sort of know how to do this, and now what we just need to do is be able to sort of access the resources to do that. Admission Possible was founded entirely with private sector dollars, and we continue to receive the majority of our support from the private sector. About 25% of our funding comes from both federal and state grants, including, as was mentioned earlier, Admission Possible is a recipient of an ICAP grant. We get $26,000 per year for this biennium from that program. About three-quarters of our dollars come from the private sector. So that's sort of what our funding base looks like, and now we're just kind of continuing to seek those resources to be able to deliver our services.
What's your total budget?
Just about $2 million.
A year?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's not much. Okay, well, thank you very much for staying till the end of the agenda. I really appreciate it, and thank you, members who stayed. And is anyone heard? Are we coming back tomorrow?
We haven't heard?
Madam Chair, I have you on my calendar.
No, we're canceled.
No, we canceled that meeting.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
That was good. There are too many other meetings going on, and now they're not going on. I think a lot of meetings have been canceled tomorrow. Okay, meeting's adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you very much.